This is Open Mic Live. Let's go! Welcome to this week's episode. We have a very special guest coming. Welcome back to Open Mic Live. I'm very excited about today's episode. It's packed with insight, inspiration, and as always, some exciting updates. Before we dive in, let me quickly share with you what's happening behind the scenes. This week's interview is hosted by Hike, as I'm working on something incredibly special for the holiday season. I'm going to reveal all details next week, but trust me, you want to stay tuned. A wave of talent, surprises, and giveaways is coming your way, and I can't wait to share it all with you. Now, let's talk about today's guest, Thijs Maas. Thijs and I go way back. We both graduated from the same bachelor's program nearly a decade ago. He was part of the very first class of the program, so as you can see, he's no stranger to taking bold risks. Hike will be chatting with Thijs about his entrepreneurial journey, the business he has built, and the strategies that have fueled his success so far. What I've always admired about Thijs is his genuine curiosity and the depth he brings to any conversation. In this interview, he shares practical advice for aspiring entrepreneurs, including one of my favorite takeaways. When you ask people for money, they give you advice. And when you ask them for advice, they give you money. Isn't that the truth? Before we get started, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, leave a review, and let us know what topics you'd like to hear more about. We are here to keep the conversation going with you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of Open Mic Live with Thijs Maas.
Hike! On the mic.
Welcome back, everybody, on Open Mic Live. This time with Hike on the mic and back at you. We have a very special guest joining us. It's a good old friend of mine, Thijs Maas. And we believe that this is a good complementary addition to an earlier episode that I've hosted, the one with Martin Müller on VC investments, namely because Thijs Maas has been spending his last couple of years raising funds for his own startup, OnRamper. OnRamper is the company that Thijs currently is also the CEO and founder of, and it also gives us a great insight into the world of cryptocurrency, not specifically on trading, I guess. We are much more on a different aspect of the cryptocurrency. I'll let Thijs fill you in on that, considering that it kind of resembles also the name of the company. So without further ado, Thijs, I want to welcome you on this episode of Open Mic Live. Thank you for joining us. Maybe we can kick it off with, you know, maybe you can tell a little bit about yourself, how we met, where we met, what you were doing at the time, and how that kind of evolved into what you're doing right now.
Yeah, for sure. Happy to. So podcast is quite a bit overdue as well, because Hike and I go way back. I think at least 10 years now, going back to our days studying in Tilburg University. So we actually met there through mutual friends, always have remained strong friends ever since. And at the time, I was myself studying law. I ended up doing nothing along the lines of law in my later career. But yeah, happy to dive into a little bit of the learnings, a little bit of the insights, a little bit of story around that.
Curious about the legality of the crypto world. And I believe that you might be a perfect person to kind of give a little bit of insight of its nuances.
Yeah, for sure. So maybe chronologically, because that's very deep dive. What happened after I graduated is that I followed sort of the old beaten career path that you expect to take when you're an aspiring lawyer, right? You take internships at these big law firms, and gradually you're getting introduced to more and more topics in different legal areas. Of course, you have to very much work your way up. Now, I was a bit Maybe arrogant is not the right word, but I've always been quite ambitious in terms of the impact I wanted to have. And while it was very cool and interesting to be exposed to all sorts of different parts of, especially I was in transactions capacity, so mergers, acquisitions, IPOs, etc. I very quickly felt that I would love to work somewhere in a space where there was a little bit less competition based on seniority, a bit more competition based on merit, and more sort of more room for me to put my own footprint. Now, I started doing so bit by bit by writing a lot about the things that fascinated me. So I wrote for publications like Hacker Noon Online and Medium, where I published basically on any topic that fascinated me on the intersection between law and blockchain, law and cryptocurrency, basically ranging from securities legislation to aspects of privacy regulations, GDPR, and the intersections with blockchain-based business models. And bit by bit, I started noticing that a lot of startups reached out to me in order to get my take on something, in order to get me to help them out here and there. And doing so, basically from a grassroots stance, one day I woke up and I really dreaded going to a law firm. And I was like, but wait a second, I'm spending all of my free time just for fun helping out all of these startups, but I'm dreading going to this law firm. Well, why don't I, you know, quit one and monetize the other, right? So that's how I initially got involved in the crypto space and startups, and it's gotten quite out of hand from a hobby since then.
Yeah, certainly, because talking about a hobby that got out of hand, you've been working on OnRamper now, I would dare to say, almost 5 years?
Yeah.
And you have, I think, raised well over 6 million. It has been a journey. It has been an investment journey for you. I'm very interested how that evolvement of company went from an early startup and how that kind of reflected on you as Thijs.
Yeah, sure. Maybe it's interesting to hear an outside perspective from your end as well, to see whether you've seen things that I haven't on my personal development, because you've been quite close to it. So
yeah.
I think initially I got fascinated helping other startups. And very quickly I noticed that my interest was broader than law alone, where I was primarily helping with go-to-market compliance. I also wanted to get involved in product decisions and generally business tactics, strategy, go to market as a whole, not just the compliance aspect. And I realized also that my own time as a business model wouldn't scale well towards the future. So because of that, I started really going even level deeper. Instead of helping startups, I started helping build startups. So went to a lot of hackathons, sort of trying to see what kind of problems are out there, what people are trying to solve for, what the gaps are in the market. And bit by bit, started working on different things. Had a little detour in education as well, but primarily was focused on what are the real problems that need solving within the crypto space. At the time, so this is 2019, I primarily... well, we first started building something cool, which was called Smart BNB at the time, which was basically a bridge between blockchains. So for if you don't know, Bitcoin is token on Bitcoin, the blockchain. It's a very simplified way of saying this, but every blockchain can have its own native token as well as different other tokens or cryptocurrencies issued on top of it. Now, the problem is that each of these blockchains is separate. And especially going back to 2019, this was a problem that was barely solved for. So these were closed ecosystems. So we thought, what if we bridge these ecosystems together? What if we can create something that allows Bitcoin to live on Ethereum, another blockchain? Or in our case, we started connecting Binance Chain to a chain called Neo, because some of the functionalities of Neo, namely smart contracts, would be very helpful for Binance Chain, which didn't have it at the time, at least. So that's how we got started building. Then Binance itself Neil funded us for this, but at some point along the journey, Binance decided to build their own smart contracting blockchain, which is kind of funny because the tweet of CZ, I remember quite well, was about a few months before our big launch of this protocol. It basically said, announcing Binance Smart Chain, our own smart contracting blockchain. And we looked at this tweet and we're like, all right, we're dead on arrival. Let's start again from scratch. Let's find a new problem to solve for, which was kind of funny. And that also introduced me for the first time to the concept of pivoting and sort of adjusting your business model if there's no product market fit, no problem solution fit. Which that was the first time we did that, but definitely not the last time.
Yeah, well, perhaps a good thing that you pivoted away from it, because I believe a couple of months after that, Binance had no market anymore here in the Netherlands. They lost some licenses, got fines. And I was on Binance myself at the time, and I remember I couldn't make normal transactions, which brings me to the topic of on-ramper and on-ramping in general. Perhaps for the average Open Mic Life listener, you can give a bit of an understanding of what on-ramping is.
Yeah, sure. So two pivots further, we realized something that was in the basic sort of in its foundations quite simple, but solving for it was quite hard. There's a lot of different places where people want to keep cryptocurrencies in digital wallets, in exchanges, or in embedded wallets, etc. The problem is that it's not very easy, or especially at the time, was not very easy to get access to cryptocurrencies because all of these places where you could store it didn't necessarily want to sell cryptocurrencies because of regulations. Because in order to sell crypto to your users, you need the right licenses in the right locations. And all of these companies, of course, and crypto as a phenomenon is global by nature. So that means that if you want to ensure that you can have users buy crypto in your platform, you need to work with a whole range of different brokers worldwide that have the right licenses for each jurisdiction. Now, these third parties that you can integrate for that, these brokers, they are called on-ramps, right? So the on-ramp is basically the part of a crypto app where you can buy crypto. Often it's third-party infrastructure. We saw this. And we said, well, wait a second. Are you going to tell me that every crypto app in the world is going to do the same work of integrating the APIs of every one of these on-ramps, these brokers? That's just not efficient from a market perspective. And it's a lot of opportunity cost because they have to invest a lot into actually building this out. So we said, well, why don't we provide a single plug? Why don't we provide a single infrastructure through which they can integrate all of these APIs at once. And that's how OnRamper was born. So very briefly and sort of quickly summarized, OnRamper is basically the plug for wallets and crypto apps to allow their users to buy crypto, whether that's with cards, credit cards, etc. Or in the Netherlands, we have iDEAL. In India, you'll see people using UPI primarily. In Brazil, you'll see people using Pix primarily, basically worldwide.
So the connecting factor between different blockchains and to allow actually users to gain access to these different ones.
Yeah, exactly. And
Yeah.
then especially between fiat currencies and on-chain currencies.
Yeah. So you also said that you were like maybe a bit curious about how I've seen this journey for you evolve. Well, you come over as a very sociable, very connected guy. And you are, I know you have always been, well, before you went into entrepreneurship, when you were, still studying law at the time, I recalled you like that. What did change? I do really notice, and I really kind of value that as well, is that me and you started to have much more, conversations about business specifically. I think that was, this whole entrepreneurial journey for you made you also a much more business-oriented person. And before that, I think I didn't even dare to start a conversation about the, I don't know, global law and all kinds of legal frameworks that you work in. So that I really appreciate. What I have also noticed is, guys, it is really hard to get a hold of you, man. Like one day you are somewhere in a different continent, the next day you're back in the Netherlands, and 2 days later you're gone again. So yeah, I did notice that it took a bit of a toll on your personal time, I guess. But overall, it added a lot of quality to the conversations that we have had. Something
Yeah,
else that
this
also.
is interesting. Interesting place where if you have to travel a lot for business, but you're not at stage yet to fly business class, it's not the best place to
It's
be.
not worth mentioning in that case. Yeah, of course. So speaking about this development and evolvement, before all of this path could have been drawn out for you, I believe you have encountered perhaps some mentors in your life. But I just wanna put that on steroids, right? Mentors on your life, maybe look at specific icons, which brings me to my next question is, so which historical figure helped shape your philosophy of life? And who is doing that now?
So it's interesting because in our prep, you sent through some general sort of ideas around how what to talk about today, right? And this question actually really got me thinking of, it's a very good question. And I think going through this sort of for myself, one of the most impactful people, at least on me professionally, in terms of my career, has been the brother of my granddad, which is sort of a counterintuitive thing. So this guy is massively impressive. We're talking about a guy that went from being uneducated to eventually no fluently speaking 8 languages, being friends with the Pope, being a very early venture capitalist within sort of the North African region, to having started a university in Mali. And I had the pleasure of being able to spend time with him, and he had sort of his he basically had a car accident and had to relearn how to walk, how to talk, etc. But sometimes he would have very moments with a lot of clarity, and I was lucky to, at a family reunion, be able to spend some time with him in a moment where he had his full clarity, basically. And we were chatting about life, and this was when I was just rolling out of university, and I was like, yeah, I don't know, I just spent 5 years on this law thing where it was fun. I had a great time during uni. I think it's great and all, and I can get into law firms, sure. But I don't know whether it's actually a match for me. And then he actually explained his entire life story to me, which was fascinating to hear and super insightful, because he basically went from not having been able to study to build this magnificently interesting career. And he said the red line in that has always been for him writing. So he said, whatever fascinates you, whatever you actually like, just start writing about it, start talking about it, start going to places where people talk about it, start getting involved in some sort of way. Because at the end of the day, the world is very much about building network, and network provides for opportunities that you'll identify. If people sit at home and, only dream about certain things don't come, right? You got to run into them and sort of increase the chance of things happening to you as well. So I think without that, I would have never really started writing about space, never gotten involved in what was very much a grassroots movement in a small space at the time. And I think therefore he's definitely been the most influential on me, both from a sort of mindset perspective, in terms of how opportunities are created, as well as how luck works, as a concept. And also, just looking back professionally, probably wasn't we wouldn't be having this chat in this setting context if it wasn't for that talk.
Yeah, absolutely. Putting the non-physical thoughts in the physical world. So writing, would you say you actually also write for yourself personally? So not specifically for articles or for the company, but just to throw out something there, like I write, for example, poetry when I'm feeling under the weather, or even when I'm feeling happy. But it's for my personal experience. It's from what it does to me from within.
Yeah. I mean, that's an extremely healthy habit, right? There's a lot of people that really ascribe to this idea of journaling, whether daily or whether weekly or monthly or whatever cadence. And that's for a reason, because having to write something down and articulate something in written form means having to structure thoughts and simplify, right? Often your thoughts are sort of a mess before they're structured into a more sort of condensed version, and something that can seem entirely complex when you start writing about it can seem very simple, which is very interesting. I talk about this as if I actually do this quite a bit. That's not the case, but I do definitely see the value.
Hey, and so this brother of your grandfather, you want to like maybe do a shout out, mention his name?
Oh, Peter, yes.
Pete. Yes. So Pete eventually went into VC, and this is your historical icon. Is there someone nowadays that is inspiring you to move into new paradigms, into I don't know, different sectors perhaps, or is doing something so cool in their own industry that you are, you feel like someone should like mention that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, right? There's definitely a lot of people that I would describe sort of the characteristic traits inspiring to. For me, I like to look closely around me, and there's definitely been mentors that helped me figure out my way through the space. And I think that if there's anything that's extremely high value for anyone that's young and ambitious to do, is to find people that believe in you, people that want to spend time with you to brainstorm, to be a mirror to your thoughts and your ideas. And I've had the pleasure of having a number of different mentors over the years that have been very inspiring, very in terms of both what they did, but also in terms of their attitude towards life and in terms of sort of how they make things happen in general. Aside from that, I think there's also been quite a bit of impact on me through various books that I read over the years. And you'll find very quickly that a lot of startup founders will mention Lean Startup from Peter Thiel, for example, which is really sort of startup Bible when it comes to how to think about problem solving and how to think about iterating. But a book that I enjoyed quite a bit is also Tools of Titans, which is, it's sort of on the edge of this self-help category, but what Tools of Titans does in a more interesting way than others is that instead of taking a single topic and writing 300 pages with far too many anecdotes about it, it instead spends 3, 4 pages per person to look into the habits and tools and mindsets of basically like 50 or 80 very inspiring people, which I found to be quite interesting, because it's instead of the traditional self-help book being overpacked with too much noise, too little signal, and something that can be written in like 20 pages instead, it's something that's actually more like the opposite.
Yeah, and what I like also most about Tools of Titans is you can choose your Titan, right? It can maybe some writer is not appealing to you, but there are, I don't know, like over 30, really famous people in there, and each one of them has written the chapter, and I believe they're like divided in like three sections: health, wealth, and well, I'm not that far yet, but there was another section. I love that book, and I love how you also draw your inspiration from people close to you. You know, when I mentioned the historical icon, I love how you looked within your direct circles, and I feel like that has given you the ability to also access much more in depth knowledge from those people in your life. Something else that I would that I wanted to talk about with you is having access to capital. Mm-hmm. You have successfully raised for OnRamper, and I am, you know, dealing with startups quite regularly that want to raise and that face a lot of hurdles, a lot of challenges to actually do that. A lot of it is also just being investor ready, I believe. But perhaps to become investor ready, Thijs, when do you have the feeling like, yes, I'm raising now and I'm going to succeed in raising, let's say, a seed round?
Yeah, there's a lot of different philosophies on this topic. Right now, I'm in a luxury position where if I would go out and raise, I can raise quite an amount based on just sort of past track record and ability to generate value, right? But as starting entrepreneur, my advice would always be to raise when you don't need to raise. In general, people will give you money when you ask for advice and give you advice when you ask for money. And the best situation you can be in to receive money is when you don't need it. That being said, and sort of contradictory to that, I also believe that you should only raise when you really need it, because you know that every dollar, every euro you're going to spend is going to return a certain amount of return on investment that you just know is there, and not that you believe might be there in the future if you do X, Y, and Z with all sorts of assumptions and projections towards the future that are basically near meaningless, but actually instead knowing that, hey, look, we cannot keep up with market demands. We cannot keep up with all of these clients. We're trying, we're doing 14-hour days, but we really need additional people. We know that we really need to build feature X, Y, Z, because there's a party that already has said, yeah, if you build this, we'll be your design partner and we'll build it out and we'll buy it from you, etc. That's when you need to raise money, right? Very early projects, that is just sort of friends, family, fools. For pre-seeds, you'll find angels, ex-entrepreneurs, or just sort of wealthy individual family offices, etc. And then after that, you really go to sort of VC landscape, assuming that you want to build a VC growth business.
Yeah, especially that stage that you are kind of really early, but you know you have the traction, you know that there is going to be a return on investment. Let's say you're looking for an angel. I think at some point you also had a couple of angels join you. How do you find them? How do you create the chemistry? It's almost like a marriage to me, right? If as a founder you get an angel, a single investor on board, there needs to be a good feeling about each other.
Yeah, sure. So there's philosophy and practice, right? What I believe very strongly is that you should, when raising, focus on vision fit more than economical terms, right? So valuation is going to be less important at the end of the day than making sure that the person who you're getting on your board or who you're getting involved somehow or only monetarily actually supports you as founder, supports your vision as a business, and will be there for what you need to do in the future as well, right? In practice, how do you find people? Well, you grind it out, right? So I remember that for our first raise, so first we got some development grants, which like 20-30k maybe, and we were paying ourselves 400 euros a month just so we could buy some food, right? But then we ended up raising 500k in our pre-seed round. Now, the way that worked is that we essentially pitched, or we sent messages to 1,000 plus different investors that we had identified that we knew had some interest in the space that we're in or fintech in general and knew that we're active angels. And we pitched over 150 different angels at the time in order to get that round together, right? So 150 different ones before we finally got this together, right?
Well, I would expect you would have perfected by then.
Yeah, you know, you get better at it. You start. We made tons of mistakes as well. We went for our first round to VCs while the business was far too early.
Do you know how many made that mistake? I speak to so many very early stage companies that just want to raise a VC round. And I'm like, do you even know how cap tables work, right? Because in this case, VCs, the danger of having a VC on board quite early on, let's say you are sitting on a gold mine, so to say, is that, you know, they are equity investors and they will try to get as much as equity as they can in most cases.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, at the end of the day, you know, people invest because there needs to be a return on investment. Now, the cool thing about the VC model is that not every startup is going to be a winner for them, right? So it's not a situation where if as a startup you absolutely fail and you really try and pivot and fail again and you keep trying and pivot and you get some traction, but it doesn't really work out, that you're going to have these VCs on your boards just absolutely throwing shit at you for underperforming, right? It's all about trying to get them a return on investment, but they also know that 90% of startups fail, right? So the earlier capital it is, the more risk there is related to that investment. And the sort of image of the VC that's only optimizing for themselves isn't entirely true. I think that's something that coming out of sort of the YC narrative of, hey, as accelerators, we are more founder-friendly and we help you connect founder-friendly VCs and this and that. But at the end of the day, I think most VCs are founder-friendly. I think that it's only at sort of a series A, B, C that you get more professional investors that don't have to really care about their reputation towards on how they treat founders and sort of early employees, where people become more savvy and more business-like in the way they deal with their investments. And, so I think there's a bit of a misconception of early stage VC. That being said, I do always warn very early founders to make sure that in their first raise, they don't take money from investors that don't invest, right? Because it's such a numbers game. If somebody mentally overcommits because they only have one or two angel investments in startups and therefore is absolutely manic and panics with every little wind blow, that's going to be working against you quite a bit, right?
Yeah, especially if you don't have good agreements on what type of seat that investor gets. Is it an observatory seat or is it actually, you know, operational? Well, I think we've arrived to the point where Thijs, we've painted a good image of how your career has evolved and perhaps where you are now. Not sure where you are going, but perhaps interesting to give a little bit of insight what OnRamper is working on now, and if you have any other, I don't know, side projects that you might be, you know, be working on for in the future.
Yeah, so side projects, not really, because at the end of the day, you do really commit on a single thing as a founder in many cases. What we're working on now is very much access to crypto, right? So we mentioned, yeah, we make access to crypto easier, especially for all of these wallets and third-party applications. But we more and more see that there's a big need in sort of emerging markets to get easier access. That means countries like Indonesia, Nigeria, Philippines, as well as Brazil, India, where there's a quite active population when it comes to crypto usage, but the use case is often very different. it also differs between these countries. In some countries, it's very much about escaping inflation, getting access to the dollars. And in some others, it's very much about just getting access to crypto in general. So what we focus on very much is making that as easy as possible, making sure people can use the local payment methods that they're used to, and also making it as cheap as possible.
From what I'm hearing, you already got the flywheel rolling. Thijs, perhaps for aspiring entrepreneurs that want to have this journey, you know, maybe at least as successful as you have had it. Do you have some I don't know, just shoot in dark three habits that they can take with them that will help them achieve this success?
Yeah, sure. So I'll try to tie together some things from this conversation. So focus on the right investor more than economic terms, which means vision fit over valuation. B, raise when you have to raise, and hire only when you have to hire. And C, when you really have to hire, don't overscale. I would say I would focus on getting people that are 5Xers, 10Xers that really are far better at what they do than you ever have been at doing their role. Because the reality is you have been doing their role and it's time to give sort of that hat away because you're wearing too many. And then you need to find someone who's 5X better. I think those are three things that are incredibly important and often don't go very well.
Thijs, I really want to thank you on your contributions to Open Mic Life, and I really enjoyed it. Great insights. I really hope to invite you over on a different episode. We've been thinking of having something with more guests. We still have to select that guest, but we would be honored if you could, you know, at some point reappear and give us an update on what you're doing at that point in time. Yeah, thanks for that, my man.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, let me know about that. Always happy to join. And it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, catch you soon.
Thank you for tuning in. See you next week on Open Mic Life.